Taking a look now at climate and weather with our weather guys. Steve Ackerman with me right now. Steve directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison. He's also a professor of atmospheric sciences. John Martin will be with us soon. John chairs the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. And as is usually often the case, this time of the day, he's teaching. So he'll be with us pretty close to noon, I would guess.
Yeah, he usually comes running in around then, out of breath and all excited.
All excited. So we're looking at questions from you today. How closely do you monitor forecasts, for example? Do you plan things around them, or do you just take the weather as it comes? You think March comes in like a lion and goes out like a lamb? Well, we'll see what Steve and John have to say about that. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And, you know, just thinking about this, if you noticed, well, you would have noticed a different odor as you came in the studio today. Lucky the penguin. And he was the nicest penguin. But
yeah, he looked pretty cute. The education penguin. His cage was stamped.
Yeah,
his carrying case.
But he did have to poop once, but he did it in the cage. So.
He did. Well, that's good. He didn't do it in your lap or anything.
No. Yeah, didn't do it in my lap. Did it in the cage. So it's a little different in here than it normally is.
So it's not me. I thought maybe.
I want you to know it's not me.
Oh, okay.
Oh,
well, let's not explain it to John. See if he can figure it out.
Yeah, let John figure it out. Well, so at this point, where are we as far as winter compared? Let's take average temperatures and average snowfalls behind.
Yeah, we're behind in average snowfalls and way up in temperature. I think we're about the sixth warmest winter so far, you know, since over 100 years, since the 1880s, 1860s.
Wow.
So, yeah, we're each month for February, January, and December, our winter months, we've been anywhere from 5 to 6 degrees above normal for the monthly average.
That's really huge.
Yeah, it's really big. But it's not, you know, it's not the warmest. In fact, I don't think it's even closest to the warmest. There was in 98, I think it was. We were so warm that by now, you know, the ice was off the lakes completely. So
98.
In 98, yeah. 1998. Yeah. Right. Let me clarify that, because we do talk about a couple of years, you know, 150 years or so.
Wow. Well, the last couple of snowfalls we had really big snowflakes.
Yeah. And it was gorgeous, particularly this last one, because in this last one, which I think was on Thursday, you know, it stuck to everything as well.
Yeah.
And that's what helps make big snowflakes. There's two things. One is the shape of the ice crystals, and then what the temperature is. And snowflakes, if you look at those big ones, they're not a single crystal. You know, there's a whole bunch of them that are stuck together.
Put together.
Put together or aggregated together. And the way you get them to stick is to have them be the dendritic structure, which means they have like six branches. And then if they hit, they collide and they interlock. Or you have a very temperature that's near freezing, you know, so they have a little bit of water on them. And then when they collide, they stick. So if they have a thimble, you know, like your tongue on a flagpole, you know, not you know, kind of sticks that way.
Oh man, well, last if I'm remembering from last fall, the forecasts were for colder, snowier winter
that was
than usual, and certainly hasn't turned out that way.
Yeah, it certainly hasn't turned out the colder. They were certainly going a little bit colder because it was a La Nina year, and they usually expect that to be colder. But that certainly hasn't turned out the case. And for precipitation, they weren't really sure about what was going to happen. There was no real strong signal either way in terms of an abnormally high or an abnormally low snowfall. There was some private companies predicting really disastrous winters, which did not occur. So you may be thinking about them, but in terms of the National Weather Service.
So they were
off on the temperature for sure, for Wisconsin, for sure. Because we were, as I was saying, pretty warm.
And what was there something that, some reason for that, for being off, or for some reason for it to be that much warmer? Let's put it that way.
Because all the cold air slipped over Europe. So instead of coming down our way, it was over Europe. It got pushed out down there. So, you know, Venice had the canals froze. Rome had snow. This is not a winter you want to be in Europe.
Oh, so we were, so we kind of, well, depending on how you look at it, we got lucky.
Right, yeah, depending on how you look at it. I think John would say we were unlucky because he likes winter, but most people I've talked to have been really pleasant about this winter.
Oh, man. You can join in, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page as well at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd love to hear from you. The ice on the Wisconsin and Minnesota lakes has been thin this year.
Yeah.
Number of folks have gone through the ice.
Yeah, and I think in January there were 3 people who had died. And I think I read also in February that even around here some people had been falling in. But, you know, that's what happens when you get a warmer winter. You know, that ice just didn't get very thick.
To begin with. Yeah, and oftentimes if you get a little snow on it, that doesn't help.
Yeah, right, because snow insulates.
Yes.
And so, yeah, if you don't have snowfall then and you have cold weather, then that ice can thicken by cooling off. Yeah. But when you have the snow, it acts like a blanket, and it kind of keeps it from getting thick.
So do we have much? So do we have much winter left, you think?
Well, we never really had a winter, one might argue.
Yeah.
Well, there's a storm coming up on Tuesday for northern Wisconsin. Whether it'll get this far south, I'm not sure. And then there, you know, in terms of precipitation, looking out a few days, you know, Thursday, Friday, it gets a little cautious, I would say. But they're looking for precipitation down here and probably rainfall later in the week.
So is there there's not a reason to be concerned about the lack of moisture? We're not that far behind, or certain parts of the state, we're still behind in the north.
Yeah. The north is still, in terms of like drought conditions,
yeah.
They're still, very dry up north in the UP. Down here, we're not so bad. We're kind of average, and, you know, precipitation fluctuates so much that, you know, when you're 80 to 120% above normal, that doesn't, you know, it's kind of like normal.
Mike in Milwaukee will turn to you. Hi, Mike. Thank you for calling.
Okay. My question is this. There were several times we were supposed to get lots of snow and it turned out to be rain. So when you think not in terms of snow, but in terms of actual precipitation, how do we compare there? And I'll take the question off the air.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because when we start talking about snowfall, particularly recently, you know, where at one point they may be forecasting 6 inches of snow, and then all of a sudden they're down to 1 or 2, there are two things. One is, where is that band of heavy snowfall going to occur? And recently we've been missing it, and it's been to the south of us. And then the other is, how much snow you get is a function by how fluffy the snow is. And so the way that we normalize that is you basically catch the snowfall over the area and then you melt it down. And you go to what we call the liquid equivalent snowfall amount. So if it fell as a liquid, how deep would that be? And so you can have a very wet snowfall of only, you know, like 2 inches of snowfall, and it could be the same liquid equivalent water as a 10 or 12 inch snowfall, just because that 10, 12 inches, so much lighter. There's so much more airspace in between.
Hmm. Thanks, Mike. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I'm surprised at the amount of variability. Well, I guess I shouldn't be surprised. But there's, in terms of snow, I had part of my driveway, which is open. There's no trees over it, and there wasn't any really wind. It's fairly protected. I had the other day 6 inches of snow.
Yeah,
and on the other side of town, which is like a mile away or 2 miles away, they're talking an inch or hardly got any.
Yeah, I live in the north end. We live on the north end of Madison up by Westport, and we had about an inch, and that was it. And when I woke up that morning, it was beautiful because everything was covered. But yeah, I was just like, oh, darn, we didn't get much. And then I got online, and everybody's talking about 5 inches and 6 inches at their house. So you can get these really sharp gradients in precipitation, which we had
And in a
week.
Very short.
Yeah,
distance.
Yeah, in a very short. And in some cases, when we get to the summertime, you know, when we start talking about thunderstorms, there have been times where, you know, I'm on one end of the street and it's raining, and you look on the other side and it's not raining at all.
Oh, man. Steve Ackerman, our guest today, as we talk with him about weather, John Martin will be joining us in just a couple of minutes. You can join in with a question or comment at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a question or a comment there. You know, all these names, Alberta Clippers and there's a Hookers.
Oklahoma Hookers.
Oklahoma Hookers. I heard one the
other. And we're talking weather here. We're not talking.
We're talking weather. But there was one from Saskatchewan. There was a Saskatchewan. Have you heard the Saskatchewan one? I couldn't remember.
Saskatchewan slider, maybe?
I could not. I'm really sorry now that I brought it up because I can't remember the rest of the term. Saskatchewan something.
Yeah, so these are named after storms of like an Alberta Clipper.
Clipper, yeah.
Comes out of Alberta and moves really fast and just clips the northern part of the U.S. and dumps precipitation. When a hooker comes out of the Front Range regions and then hooks up and hits the Great Lakes. And John just joined us. Maybe he knows what a Saskatchewan.
Anything?
I never heard the Saskatchewan one before. I think the Albertans will tell you the only thing good that comes out of Saskatchewan is an empty bus. But I don't know. I don't want to get in that fight. I've not heard of the other, though.
Oh, man. Well, see, I get up to Saskatchewan every so often. That's why it was I saw it on a weather forecast, one of the local forecasts.
Hmm. Oh, maybe it's a Canadian term. You know, because the terms that we're using are the storms that affect us.
Yeah, well, maybe it's right. This was one of the Madison radio.
Television. One of the Madison.
Yeah, it was a Madison television station.
I never heard of that.
And the Saskatchewan something or other. And we're going to get it. Somebody's going to be listening in. Oh, here we go. Caller Phil says it's a Saskatchewan screamer.
Screamer. Okay, I could see that.
So instead of coming out of Alberta, it comes out of Saskatchewan and zips through.
And one of the characteristics of these types of storms is the really strong winds they sometimes bring. So that might be why they get that moniker, yeah.
Okay. Hey, Phil, thank you. Thank you for letting us know that, we had all the lines filled and a bunch of people just hung up because there must have been more than one person.
People who know a lot more than us.
Yeah. knew the answer to that one. Well, you can still call in, and we have some callers in, but you can join in too at 1-800-642-1234. Talking today with Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW-Madison, John Martin, professor and chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at the UW. They're with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. So happy to have you listening in here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking climate and weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin from the UW-Madison. Great to have you listening in. Thanks to them for coming by. And Thomas in Manitowoc has a question or comment. So let's go to Thomas. Hi, Tom.
Hi, I've got one here that might be a bit of a stretch for you guys, but I was always wondering, why do fish turn on when there's a low pressure, when they're down in the water? I can see how animals above ground know when there's a storm and they have to feed before the snow and all that, but when you go fishing on a high-pressure day, man, you can see them down there, and they will just not bite.
Yeah, and that storm comes in, and it makes all the difference in the world.
Yep. And, you know, I think it was last spring where I actually did a lot of background research to look at that to try and figure out why that might be the case. And there were different theories out there, but none of them were really convincing to me of why pressure variations like that would modify fish feeding behavior, unless it's doing something to, you know, what they feed on, you know, insects and things like that. Maybe that's causing the change. But I looked into this and I couldn't satisfy myself that, yeah, that's the cause. You know, there was things with regard to their air bladders and things, but I just didn't think how, you know, the small changes in atmospheric pressure could really affect the pressure on the water where these fish are living.
Well,
living.
It would seem to go in the wrong direction, too. I mean, if they behave this way, if they shallowed when the pressure got high and then went deeper when the pressure went low, you could say, oh, yeah, they're trying to keep some sort of ballast, you know.
Right.
But it's just the opposite.
Yeah.
So I don't get that.
And maybe with the water, you know, with the low pressure, also you get winds, and that might stir it up enough, so that some food off the bottom comes, or if the water's too clear, maybe they're afraid of being hunted. I don't.
Yeah, you can see them better if it's sunny too, I suppose.
But when I go bass fishing, I look at the pressure and I look at the winds. You know, winds from the east, fish bite least. Winds from the west, fish bite west.
I'm glad that there is no positive answer, because now we have a controversy we can argue about.
That's right. Why are you waiting for them to
bite?
Right.
That's exactly right. I was thinking of a time when I was muskie fishing on Lake Winter, Wisconsin, or Lake Winter, and a storm front came up, and I was fishing with my dad, and as the storm was starting and through the storm, I caught 13 muskies.
Wow.
Whoa.
And my dad just sat there and ran the net. I happened to have a lure that, and if I didn't get a hit on every cast, it was like, what? Nothing hit. Nothing hit. Again. And believe me, these weren't all record keepers, but there were a couple of nice
keep
ones
your action,
in a bunch.
Wow.
And, you know, some people say you need 10,000 casts. I got 13 in 45 minutes.
Wow.
In a rainstorm. The minute the rain quit, that was the end of it.
Wow. High pressure moves in behind the front.
But not that fast. It's got to be
no,
the stirring
that's true.
Up. It's got to be the stirring up that you were thinking.
Yeah.
If there's any reason, that's it.
Right. But there are times like this when, you don't know it, but follow it.
Yeah, that's right.
Dad said, I should have had pictures of all those. Well, I mean, it was raining and I was busy.
Right. Yeah. And so was your dad, apparently.
Oh, man. Larry in Dunn County. It's your turn. Hi, Larry.
Hi, guys. Say, all my life I've been interested in fun facts. Well, as fun as they can be in a weather situation where people lose their lives. But I was 7 in 1949 when the Great Armistice Day blizzard swept up through. I grew up in northern Chippewa County up here, and nobody died up here like they did along the Mississippi River, but there were a lot of people who were in precarious situations because it was such a beautiful day when that thing hit. And so it was really a feature of my growing up. And I was probably about 12 years old when I heard this story. And your mentioning the Oklahoma hooker earlier brought it to mind, because I remember seeing the newsreels of the great Tacoma Narrow Straits Bridge called Galloping Gertie and falling in.
Yeah.
And when I was about 12, I was told that same weather system that took out the Tacoma Narrows Bridge it went southeast and hooked up with what I was told was a Texas hooker, and then it came straight up into the the Great Lakes region and dumped and killed quite a few people, as I recall. Yeah. I was 7 when it happened, but it was a feature of everybody's discussion for the next 10 years, I guess. And I'm just fact-checking my fun fact.
Your fun fact is correct. That's the same storm that took down the Tacoma Narrow Bridge as the same storm, the 1940 Armistice Day storm that, you know, killed 150-something people in the Great Lakes regions because it came so quickly.
Yeah.
Well, if we are indeed all connected by weather, we probably are all connected by global warming then, huh?
Oh, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
In fact, that kind of storm is interesting as an analog to some we've just recently had that might suggest how the tropics and the extratropics work together to create such monster storms here in our own part of the world. So really interesting.
Yeah, explain that.
Well, I'm guessing, guessing by analog, we had a storm here in October of 2010 that was devastating.
Oh.
Very rapid developing storm. Wasn't quite cold enough for snow in our region, but we had winds over 70 knots and, some people lost their lives in that. And that one had its roots in the outflow from Hurricane Super Typhoon Meggy in the Philippines some week or so earlier. And that molds the tropopause and intensifies the jet in ways that we're just beginning to understand. And I wouldn't be surprised if the November storm in 1940 was like that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised at all.
And so here's another little interesting fact, since you collect them, is that after the bridge went down, of course, they had a you know, they had to look into why did it go down. So they brought in a lot of famous people. One of those was Von Karman.
Oh, was that right?
Yeah, the Von Karman vortex. Yeah, yeah, a very famous meteorologist.
Oh.
That was kind of got him into doing meteorology.
Mm-hmm. How do you, I didn't know that. That's neat.
Very cool. Thank you, Larry. Lauren in Marquette, Michigan. On to you. Hi, Lauren.
Hi. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Well, my question, I heard that, I don't know if I read it or heard it on the radio, sometime since the first of the year, that, and they were speculating, I don't think they were saying it was a fact, that there's a possibility that the tsunami that hit the Orient, hit Japan, and I think they did talk in terms of it as factual, actually changed slightly, very, very slightly, the Earth's axis. And is that a possibility or an explanation of why our winter has been so much milder than anticipated?
No, I think if you, no. to get, if you, if it did change it, or it might have changed the rotation of the Earth a little bit.
Length of the day.
Yeah. But it wouldn't, you know, to change, it would be such a small change that it wouldn't impact our weather, winter in particular.
It seemed a little far-fetched. But
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, as a Youper, I can tell you it's an extremely mild winter. I have to plow my driveway. It's about a quarter of a mile long, and normally I'm plowing it three or four times a week, and this year it's been three or four times for the season.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
No.
Wow. Yeah, it's
amazing.
Dry up there.
Let me ask you something, though. When you live up in the UP, why do you have a quarter mile long driveway?
What? I'm out in the woods.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
So the price of solitude is the constant plowing, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's not the only price.
I bet that's right.
there are offsetting positive.
Yeah.
Yeah. Understood, Lauren. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Ed in Heartland, you're next. Thank you for calling. Hello.
Yes. Good morning. Or I should say good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
We heard a lot earlier in the winter, or as we go into December, about Arctic oscillation. And I'd like a definition of that. And the other part of my question would involve, our weather pattern appears to have gotten a little bit more active in the last 3 or 4 weeks. Is that because this Arctic oscillation has, I guess I'll say, died down a bit? Just curious.
Yeah.
And thank you. I will hang up and just listen for the answer.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Ed.
The Arctic Oscillation is one of several large-scale, almost hemispheric-scale patterns, circulation patterns, that can wax and wane during the season. And I believe the Arctic Oscillation comes along with relatively low pressures over the northern Atlantic Ocean and then straddling regions of higher pressure to its west and to its east. And I think that it can make Western Europe and Central Europe pretty cold if it's in, I don't even know if it's a negative or positive phase. I'll think it's its negative phase when it's really got a deep low over Western Europe. And I think that was the case a couple of weeks ago. And as I say, it goes back and forth from positive to negative phase. My own interests have been more on watching the jet and the behavior of the jet, which I think is probably tied in with the oscillations, but I'm not sure which causes which, and that's kind of the interesting question. But the jet has been very unusual, it seems to me, in the last, this whole winter. And right now, there's an almost complete absence of a Pacific jet straddling the Pacific Ocean at about 25, 30 degrees north latitude. And that seems to me to be a relatively rare occurrence as well. So something's up this year. As it's happening, it's kind of hard to unfold it and understand it, but it's going to definitely be worth thinking about some. I don't know why it's been so strange. Of course, it hasn't been mild in Europe. So,
no.
You know, we talk about a mild winter here, and that's all true. It's very true, but it's not been mild in Europe. It's been devastating. So the hemisphere still coughed up a lot of cold air, just not over us.
You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call. We have open lines. Get you on pretty quickly. Jeff in Madison, your turn next. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, guys. Good morning. Good afternoon, folks. I was just wondering, since we've had the 2 year La Nina, and the second one certainly hasn't been the same as the first. And if you studied it at all, and I did through the National Weather Service, they indicated that the second year La Ninas are usually far different than the first. Has there been any information, or do you have any information about the direction we're headed for the remainder of the year? Is this thing going to go neutral? We're going to get back to El Nino. What do you guys think we're looking for in the next, say, 12 months or so?
They have it heading towards a neutral condition. So the La Nina is, I was looking at that this morning, and it's weakening again and heading more towards neutral type conditions. I haven't seen anything about what might happen with El Nino. I haven't seen any forecast predicting that that would happen. But you're right. You know, last year we were still under La Nina conditions stronger, and we did have colder than normal wintertime. Last year, and this year that hasn't been the case, even though we've been in a La Nina situation.
Right. Yeah. And I guess the last thing is there any connection? In fact, I think you guys wrote about it in the paper today, and I didn't have a chance to read it in our local Madison paper. Mild winter, what happens to the spring and summer in terms of...
Yeah, it's very interesting. The Weather Service in Milwaukee did this study, and we found some of the information on their website. They've ranked the last 141 summers and springs following winters as the coldest or warmest was one, and the coldest was 141. So that's how the ranking worked. Mm-hmm. And if you take the 20 warmest winters in Milwaukee, and that's probably a pretty good proxy for Madison,
yep.
It turns out that 60%, well, I should say this, the following spring after one of those 20 warmest winters has is warmer than 60% of all other springs. And the following summer is warmer than 69% of all other summers. So it's pretty good odds that, at least from the historical perspective, that you have a slightly warmer than normal, a better than even chance of being warmer in spring and summer. And increasingly higher chance when you get to the summer. So pretty interesting.
Yeah.
Thanks, gentlemen. I appreciate your program, Larry.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jeff, for calling. Appreciate it. And Mary in Madison, we turn to you next. Hi, Mary.
Yes, hello. I had two questions about Europe. One is the jet stream. Did it make a big dip, go lower than usual? And then the Gulf Stream, did it mitigate the weather cold? I mean, did it work against the cold weather in England and Norway and France, I guess?
Well, were those places that weren't particularly cold or something?
Well, they were. Amsterdam canals froze.
Okay,
So the Gulf Stream usually mitigates that, and
except
not enough.
That's a great question.
Yeah, because it really
is. The Gulf Stream also empowers weather systems on the east coast of North America. Sometimes they can be quite dramatic storms, even if they're out to sea. So they don't particularly affect coastal regions of the United States and Canada. But they can still blossom into massive cloud systems in the central part of the Atlantic. And that can turn, it can create exactly the kind of dip in the jet stream that you're talking about, but to the east of the location where the storm is. And so sometimes the Gulf Stream contributes to the production of one of these ridges in the central Atlantic that sets Western Europe up for a dip from the north of very, very cold air. And that could well have been what happened here this winter. In fact, I think my reading of the jet stream, the polar and subtropical jet, on my current research, certainly suggested for a long period of time there was a very sharp bend in the polar jet stream just to the west of the British Isles during the month of January and part of February. So it would be exactly what you're talking about, but in a way that's a little different than what you're thinking. The warm air that kind of sits over the Gulf Stream in the lowest part of the atmosphere is only one part of the equation, and if the atmosphere in a larger scale, a deeper sense, can produce one of these anomalous structures like I think it did, then you can end up, doesn't matter much, the Gulf Stream is just a few hundred miles to your west. And I think that's what happened this winter.
Huh.
There you go. Thank you very much, Mary. Jane in Harshaw, it's your turn. Hi, Jane.
Hi, I've talked to you before. We know about the 10-point together, Larry. So. here's my question. Harshaw is the center point for a project that's has been going for 15 years, on the impact of global warming, particularly CO2, on what will happen with the lumber and paper industry, trees, aspens, and a whole bunch of other things, popple. And I believe the project's called the Aspen Project. And I don't have the ability to go online right now and look at it, but if you Google this, you'll find it very quickly. And we are teaming in this, University of Wisconsin, but also I think Finland and maybe Ukraine. The point behind my question is, coincidentally, we have been in a long drought cycle here. And if you look on the map for snowfall or rainfall, there is this bullseye with Harshaw right in the middle of it in terms of this unusual drought pattern that does not happen anywhere northeast, south, or west, but is about a 20-mile or 40-mile diameter circle. And nobody seems to have ever asked the question if there might be some kind of overlap or, you know, what's happening with this. And I'm not a big conspiracy theory person, so I'm not really concerned about that. But I know that maybe it's more than just a coincidence that we have the drought right here, right where this Aspen project is happening.
Hmm. So... it's drier than normal right where this project's going on, and not quite as dry as drier than normal in places surrounding it, you're thinking.
I know. If you go look at the map at the U.S. Weather mm-hmm. Service and the NOAA and stuff like that.
Yeah, the drought index.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You can see it. I mean, it's visual. You know, they show with colors. I can't remember how they do it. Mm-hmm. But it's a snow drought, and it's a rain drought, and it's been going on for... 2 years ago, we had a lot of rain, but in general, it's been going on for like 8, 10 years. So mm-hmm. then I just got to thinking about this Aspen project, and I thought, well, this is interesting because what they're doing is releasing in a controlled fashion CO2 into the atmosphere very close to the trees to see what happens to trees over a period of time. Because after all, Wisconsin, you know, timber industry and paper industry is a big deal, so they want to know how to plant. And
yeah,
the project has been going on for 15 years to help. It was extended, actually. It was only supposed to be 10 years, but such good data is coming out of it that it's been continued.
Yeah, my sense is that you could... I know these kind of things go on a very local scale, these projects. They're very controlled, and I don't think that this kind of a local scale change in the atmosphere composition, first of all, it won't stay in the area. As soon as you release this gas into the atmosphere... to the extent that the trees don't use it for their respiration, it just gets carried along by the winds. So it's not really going to be a permanent atmospheric composition change in that location. And there's no particular theory that would suggest that even if it were to stay local, it would have an impact on exacerbating or continuing a drought. So there's not really too much theory that connects the two circumstances.
All right, well, thank you. It was worth asking the question.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Absolutely. Thank you very much for calling. I was not aware of that particular study.
No, it's a good idea. In fact, they must be suffering, though. If there is a drought, they must be suffering from the trees can't assimilate the carbon as well as they could if it was raining.
Right, yeah.
You know, you'd think.
Yeah.
So that would
We tend to forget that trees are made of carbon.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, so, yeah, they...
I mean, they can only assimilate if they're alive.
Exactly, if they got enough precipitation. Yeah.
Well, her comments about research brings to mind a question. You know, what are you guys up to in terms of your own research? And are we doing anything in the climate change area, or are we?
Yeah, I am. I think I am, kind of. I don't really know for sure. I don't like to put a label on it, but I'm thinking about how the subtropical and polar jets interact with each other. And we're in a position to look at that from a 50-year climatological perspective and see if there's been any trends in changes. And then investigate individual, particularly strong weather events that seem to have progenitors of polar and subtropical jets, which are usually separated from each other by a significant latitude band.
Yeah.
They sometimes can get their act together for a variety of reasons, and some of these would be natural, but if you have a warmer planet, there may just be a higher incidence of these kinds of superpositions of the polar and subtropical jet, and they tend to lead to extreme weather in the mid-latitudes. So to the extent that forecasts... for a warmer climate are talking about more extreme weather events in the mid-latitudes, this might be a way in which they actually get produced, which would be nice. It'd be finally nice to hang your hat on something physical instead of just mathematical out of a model.
Yeah.
Steve, and then I'm working on a couple of projects. One is a climate change education project with some folks in NOAA and NASA, and you know, how do we educate the public about that? And then we're using some satellites, a LIDAR and a satellite called Calliope is the name of the LIDAR, to determine the boundary layer depth. So that's kind of the boundary layers where we live, and a lot of pollution gets trapped there. And we don't really know a lot about how that depth is over the globe. And for the satellite observation, we think we finally have a way to do it.
I was thinking that John might have done some research on March going in like a lion and out like a lamb. Or vice versa.
Yeah, good point.
Guess he has.
Well, it's very short-term research. It looks to me like Friday night into Saturday could be quite an interesting situation around here in the southern part of our state, in the northern part for sure. We could have a really big snowstorm here on Friday night.
So like a lion and out like a lamb?
In like a lion, and then we'll wait for the lamb on the 31st or whatever, whatever comes along. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised to have a cold, wintry first week of March. I would not be surprised at all.
Oh, wow.
Sorry.
Is it the boys' basketball tournament?
Coming up. Couple weeks,
it's coming up. Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
it's coming up. It's usually associated, or we usually think of it as think of it that way. Anyway, well, tell you what, guys. Let's if it comes in like a lion, is it going to go out like a lamb?
No, there's no guarantees. But I'd say that the chances of it going out like a lion are low, but they're not zero.
They're not zero. Okay. Thanks, guys. We'll look forward to your visit next month. Oh, my goodness. We're in March. We'll
It'll be in March, but at least we have longer days, so it'll take a little bit longer before you hear us again.
Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies and a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences. John Martin chairs that department. Great to have them with us, and they'll be back the last Monday of March, and we'll do it all over again with them. Tomorrow, Gwen Drury will be here to talk about the history of the Wisconsin Idea. Turns 100 years old. And then tomorrow at 11:45, Jim LaLuzerne has some information on eyewear. Stay with us.